Well, that might introduce our next guest. She's a South Aucklander who went to university unsure of what the future would hold, but she's ended up the head of entrepreneurship at the London-based Finance Innovation Lab. If Lydia Hascott has one message for students and young graduates in these uncertain COVID times, it's that your degree does not have to be your identity. Growing up in Papakura, she completed a business degree and an arts degree, still without a clear career path. As she puts it, navigating uncertainty is a key theme of my career. Lydia Hascott now works with mainstream finance professionals to help them embed sustainable, innovative practice and purpose in their organisations. And she also assists some large UK charities with organisational development and culture change projects. Lydia is with us from the UK. Hi, welcome.
Hi, Catherine. Great to be here.
You have to explain first what entrepreneurship is.
Yes, well, it sounds a lot like the word entrepreneurship, and it means something very similar. So essentially, people who work inside an already established organisation rather than being owners or of their own business, who are trying to be innovative and try to create some sort of change internally. That might be through developing a new product or service, but it could be something like creating a culture change in the organisation through, say, a diversity and inclusion initiative.
There are so many buzzwords around this stuff, you know, culture change, change management, innovation, building and sustainability. There's lots of terms that a lot of businesses like to use. When you are in a role that's actually about doing it, what is it that you do?
Yeah, I love that question, because a lot of the questions that we're asking ourselves in the work that I do is in the field of systems change, which is another field that has a lot of lingo and buzzwords around it, but essentially looking at what is the status quo of how business is done, what is the role of business in the world, and in my case, working with banks, why do we have banks in society, and really asking, are they fulfilling that purpose? And if they're not, what do we need to do to change it? So that's really the core of my work at the moment. It hinges on a lot of buzzwords to get the open up the doors with the corporates, really. But once we're in there, it really is around taking more of a values-based stance around what type of organisations do we want to see. So banks essentially are designed to enable us as individuals, as businesses and as communities to reach our goals and to have a thriving world within the constraints of a thriving environment. And in many ways, as we saw in 2008, the big banks around the world aren't exactly doing that. So what is it that we need to change internally? So my role is to find people who work inside these large banks who almost feel a bit like rebels and misfits in the dominant culture of their organisations and want to be a bit of an agitator inside and create some sort of positive change that makes their institutions actually serve that purpose for society and for the planet.
So who will bring you in and why? Because institutions and corporates in particular are by their nature quite conservative. There's a lot of wanting to patch, protect and do the status quo. These are normal human behaviours alongside a desire to do all these other things, you know, achieve things, deliver for customers, grow. And increasingly, as you say, for generations of workers coming through, to do so in a way that fits with their personal values, environmental values, cultural values. So who will bring you into an organisation with all these mixed kind of motives, and why will they bring you in?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a Trojan horse approach in many cases, because often individuals will be introduced to me by somebody who knows the work that we're doing. My organisation's a charity, and an independent charity, and I'll get introduced to somebody who feels this way about their industry and wants to create some positive change and be connected into a community of colleagues who are doing similar things. But I think that something that's important to point out is we often talk about the banks or the corporations like they're a monolith entity where every single person internally has this Wolf of Wall Street approach to life, the profit-hungry banker, for example. But in my experience, there are many, many people who work in these corporate sectors who genuinely care about the world they're leaving their children, who have a sense of the personal values that they hold, they're asked to leave at the door when they come to work and put on this corporate mask where they have to make a lot of money or make decisions that they might not make if it was their own home they were managing. And so it's finding those people and really providing spaces for them to connect with their personal values. And you'd actually be potentially surprised by how many senior leaders there are in banks that feel this way as well, particularly when they're getting to the end of their career. They're thinking about the legacy they're leaving their children, or they're just about to retire, and have been wondering what all of this climbing the corporate ladder for their whole career has been. So a lot of it is about, once I connect with someone, understanding who they are as a person and what they care about, and then seeing banks as complex human systems. Humans made the financial system, and so humans can recreate it, and that's what we hope to help them do.
It's a very target-driven industry, though, and I understand what you're saying. I think there's some fascinating generational change happening at the moment. For a start, that large baby boomer demographic that has innovated so much and that has moved through into senior leadership roles in all areas of society is getting to a stage of life where it's reflecting. Good point that you make there, and individuals are reflecting. And second, we are seeing a younger generation that is coming into more senior leadership positions, or actually is just shaking it up much earlier in their careers often, and at a much younger age, because they know how to utilise communication tools, social media tools. So there's a lot happening at the moment and a lot of momentum on some of the things we're talking about. However, it still sits, in the case of banking, within a very sort of targets and bottom line driven industry. So tell me again how you bring the two things together and get individuals to be able to make them work together.
Yeah, it's a great question, Catherine, because certainly there's this sense that the work that I'm doing is the warm, fuzzy stuff, and it's all very well and nice when the ways these organisations are set up is highly competitive, target-driven, as you say. So one of the things that is really helpful for that is aligning these social and environmental outcomes with business priorities. So, for example, in the case of climate change, that's a really big one for banks at the moment, because they're starting to see, in the very technical, risk-driven mindset that they have, that if they continue to finance fossil fuels and eventually government regulations with government climate targets that are being set phases out exploration of new fossil fuel oil and gas fields, for example, then they're going to have all of these assets that are stranded and are no longer worth anything. So the risk departments of these banks are going, oh, we need to start thinking about this and potentially investing in the future, which is around sustainable innovation, renewable energy and the like. And the regulators are starting to get on board with that up here in the UK. And I think the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is taking some leadership there too by setting some rules around that, saying actually it's not good for the financial system, for the stability of the economy, if we're going to have all of these big assets fall over. So linking it into those more traditional business-driven priorities is helpful.
It was the then UK governor of the central bank there, Mark Carney, who, and still does, front these things most powerfully. I remember him saying at one point, if we truly valued companies with massive unused fossil fuel assets at their literal value, given those fossil fuels cannot be burned, cannot be released, cannot be utilised over the coming decades, we'd risk crashing the stock exchange. So this was a very interesting conversation to be had. You're at this sort of nexus between the moral and personal drivers, but also making sure you can satisfy the corporate and the bottom lines. Do you ever feel like you have to compromise in that situation, or is it not really about you in the end? You're simply looking for the people who will be dealing with these things and going head to head over these things and cooperating other times on these things.
Yeah, so I think in my career, I've started to see there being two groups of people when it comes to innovation. There's the doers and there's the enablers. And certainly I see my role as having been an enabler throughout my career, building platforms for other people to change and supporting and developing them to do that more effectively. So I think it's around identifying the people who share a common set of values and really asking tough questions about how are we going to make sure that these changes are not going to be co-opted by a status quo, the status quo that we see, to continue the planet destroying money making situation that we have. So it's a very real risk when there's this language of purpose coming in. What does purpose driven business look like, or sustainable business? And as you said earlier, those are buzzwords that could be used to greenwash, to purpose wash, or they could be used to really generate some deep change. But I think COVID-19 has really opened up some new shifts in mindset, really, around what matters to us in society, what is essential, what businesses exist to do. So there's a really interesting transition that we're seeing in 2020 with the conversations around economic recovery and how do we build back better, how do we make this a just and sustainable recovery. I think the public consciousness is shifting around this as well, which makes it feel less impossible than it did previously, or less of a radical transformation.
Tell me about these people you find, in this instance inside banks, but inside organisations, who are the ones who are up for pushing for change. There is in many, many human beings an innate resistance, certainly, to radical or sudden change, and there can be sort of logical and probably evolutionary reasons for that. We test things, and when things work, we keep them, and when they don't work, hopefully we discard them. But that transition point can be very challenging for people. Tell me about those inside these organisations who are really effective at helping make it happen and happen well. Because, Lydia, I'm sure you've seen in your career it can also happen badly.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, whose ideas of what change looks like and what good looks like win out is also something to think about. There are not just millennials like me working for sustainable ends who want to seek change in organisations. There's really powerful lobby groups, for example, from the fossil fuel industry who want to see certain outcomes as well. But I think that idea of how do you see scary radical shifts, I guess, comes back to this idea of something that I've seen called the productive zone of disequilibrium. So if we push people to change too fast, we come across as alarmist or scary, and that people don't feel safe anymore and they shut down and become resistant to change, even change that might benefit them. And then there's this floor, this threshold for change, where if there's not enough of a burning platform, not enough of a reason for people to adapt their perspective or their behaviour or their how they do their jobs, then change doesn't happen either. So these effective change makers kind of exist within this zone between creating enough discomfort in people to instigate change, but not so much that people freak out and shut down. So one example would be an entrepreneur at a investment bank in New York called Amara. She works in the legal team of this bank, structuring the legals on the big deals that they do. Her role has nothing to do with sustainability, but she's really, really interested in it. So she started to build some great relationships with people who could help her to bring some of this into her work in the bank. Pretty senior people who were deciding what types of deals and products the bank was developing, people in the sustainability team, and she feels that it's building strong relationships of trust that really helped her. She launched a network for employees who were interested in sustainability and started to build a bit of a reputation for herself as someone who's keen on this stuff. And so when there was starting to become pressure in the US for banks to invest in green things, the bank wanted to do what's called a green municipal bond. And Amara's boss knew that she was really interested in this green sustainable stuff. And so she was invited to structure the legals on this deal and all of a sudden has become somebody who's doing more and more of this in the bank and has helped it be successful. And so now the bank's making that one of their key product lines. So relationships really help.
What are the characteristics of these people? Because they are going to be in growing demand. You mentioned soft skills earlier. Increasingly, we are hearing that soft skills, the communication skills, the creative skills are going to be some of the most vital assets for the workforce and certainly for leadership going forward. So these people that you meet, I'm sure they're as different as the people you meet, but the people who really are effective at working on the inside, on change and on innovation, what kind of characteristics and skills do they have? Can that be hugely variable? Some might be very strong communicators, some might be silent types.
Yeah, completely. And what type of change works for you? It depends on who you are and the skills that you have. But some commonalities are these people are really good at building informal influence. So they navigate these highly hierarchical, rigid corporate structures, not by getting a formal mandate to do things, but by building respect and buy-in from people who do have the power and resources to do things. And in order to do that, they're what I call boundary spanners. So they bridge silos inside their organization and connect people who might not actually be talking at the moment. And they build relationships with people outside their bank to bring people in to say, well, see, this is what this expert on the outside says we should be doing if somebody in the bank isn't listening to them. So they have a big network. They learn to informally influence, and they're really, really resilient. They have to choose their battles, keep an eye out for windows of opportunity to push something forward, and know when to step back, because if they push too hard, they might lose their seat at the table. So it really is a bit of detective work over the long term.
Lydia Hascott's our guest. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. As we said, she is currently involved as an entrepreneur with the London-based, she's head of entrepreneurship, in fact, at the London-based Finance Innovation Lab. It is a social enterprise. It works primarily in the finance industry and with our banks, including some big banks. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. The question also is how you came to be doing what you're doing and what the factors have been in your own career path. And this is where it's very timely. You know, we've got school kids finishing off exams at the moment. Uni exams are pretty much done. It's at the end of what has been a disrupted and difficult year for all students. And a lot of people wondering just what the economy is going to be like in the next few years, what their lives are going to be like. Your message is, don't sweat it, right? What's been your own path?
Yeah, I've had no idea what I've wanted to do with my career, but what has really helped me is understanding what my values are, understanding what some of the needs in the world are, what the context around me is, and where I think I might be able to apply my skills at any one time. So I've always carved out roles for myself in industries that are newly established, that don't really exist yet, the world of social enterprise, the world of impact investing, and that's been navigating uncertainty and the unknown. So I would say it's absolutely valid if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, to go and follow the well-worn career path to do that. It's also valid to not really know any more than one or two steps ahead of you, like stepping stones across the pond. Follow them and see where they end up. And if you're aligning to your values and the needs of the world at the time, then you'll look back and see a golden thread moving through your career that says, ah, that's who I am, that's what I do. So for me, it's enabling other people who are creating change to do that in more effective ways. But I can only say that looking back in time.
So you did a double degree, business and arts degree, and then where did you head for that first of the just one or two steps ahead?
Yeah, so I did my last year of uni on an exchange to Australia, the University of New South Wales, so decided to stay there. And I just sent a tweet, actually. I tweeted that I needed some casual work while I was looking, figuring out what to do with my life. And my flatmate retweeted it, and that ended up seeing me fall into working for a social enterprise called Club Kidpreneur that was teaching kids entrepreneurial skills in primary school. And it was super small, so I had to do the whole range of business functions and figure them all out as I went as one of the first employees. And that's where I got into social enterprise. And the next step came from people that I met in that organisation inviting me to work somewhere else. And it really has moved through networks and relationship building from then on.
What is it that appeals to you about always being in on the cusp of something rather than, I mean, a lot of people look for certainty, right? They want a skill set, they want to be in the industry, in an industry that they think is solid and they can see a way forward. For you, what is it about always wanting to walk into the uncertain where the path isn't necessarily so clear?
Well, I think my family would perhaps say I'm addicted to novelty. I love things that are new and different. But I think at the root of that, it's curiosity. I love to learn new things and to create coherence. There's something appealing to me about a landscape that seems messy and confusing, and really learning about it and starting to bring structure to that. But I think what enables me to do that uncertain work is having a great support network of people around me, of knowing what it is in my life outside of work that gives me grounding when work can feel quite unknown some days. But yeah, it's really a curiosity about the world and always asking why are things the way that they are and could they be different? What's the reason this industry, for example, exists?
Your building blocks, though, you did really well at school, high achiever at school. What else do you think are the important building blocks of, as you say, not just getting a job or having a career, but having the kind of roundedness that's going to allow you to navigate whatever's coming, based on your values, based on what motivates you? What were some of the other things that you either did or didn't do when you were younger that you would now speak to?
Yeah. I mean, I had parents who really encouraged me to take on random part-time jobs when I was right from sort of mid-high school through. So just trying lots of different things, picking up skills along the way. But also the people that I was surrounded by, I was at a local community youth group through my high school years. And at that youth group, they really encouraged us as young people to think about who we are as much as what we want to do. That our character and our values will see us in just as good stead as the things we put into our head through education. That I'm a human being as much as a human doing. So I think that sense of well-roundedness and thinking about who I am as a full human outside my career has really helped me in my career, to be honest, and that's what I'm doing today, encouraging bankers to figure out who they are and bring their full selves to work.
You were doing your business degree at an interesting time too, because it was the last great global upset before the latest one. They seem to get bigger every time we manage them. But, you know, the GFC rocked a lot of things, and particularly would have rocked a lot of things for a business student, right? Because a lot of what's supposed to work wasn't working. And we had a global financial system essentially grinding to a halt. Was that an interesting time to be at university and to be studying business, and did it change your thinking somehow?
Yeah, I think it did. I did a commerce degree, and then in my arts degree I was studying sociology. And so my business degree was saying, here's the world of business, here's how you excel, climb the corporate ladder. Meanwhile, I could see that the job prospects in that space were crumbling, and I was questioning the very premise of business or finance in particular because of the GFC. And then my arts degree, my sociology degree, was showing me that these issues of social environmental justice and perhaps the way that the lens that I have on the world through business isn't the only way to see the world. There's multiple perspectives. And so really I felt like it wasn't really a good time, and I didn't really want to go into climbing a corporate ladder, getting a grad position. But my sociology degree sort of had me say, well, the opposite of that is go and work for an NGO or a charity, and that didn't quite feel right either, because I could see some challenges in that space too. And it was really, I don't know whether it was by luck or by just the different conversations that I'd had with people that ended me up in the land of social enterprise in that first job. But that was the perfect intersection of the two. It was the world of business and the world of social and environmental change piled into one. And it showed me that you can do both profit and purpose at the same time. And I think, yeah, I'm so grateful that I landed there in between these two crises, because it's enabled me to now, coming out of uni in the global financial crisis, to be working in a career in this economic crisis that is really around how do we build back better and what does that look like now.
What sparked your move to London? You came back to New Zealand, actually, I think after Australia, didn't you, and worked again with the University of Auckland on some innovation programs. But what sparked the move then to London? Because it is regarded as one of the toughest sort of corporate scenes.
Yeah, so in Australia, I was I decided to stop being an employee, working with people who were becoming entrepreneurs and telling them that, you know, portfolio careers and freelancing is the way of the future. The jobs that primary school kids are going to have today don't exist yet. So we need to be sort of developing our own entrepreneurial skill set. So I decided to go freelance and pick up lots of different projects. And it kind of felt like I wasn't quite ready to move back to New Zealand. This was in Australia. I'd come from New Zealand to our next door neighbours, Australia, and felt like there was more of the world I wanted to see. It was actually my husband that brought us to London. He qualified as a paramedic in Australia, and they're recruiting a lot of Aussies and Kiwis into London Ambulance Service at the moment because they've got a shortage. So he got a job as a paramedic, and that really brought us over here. But I was able to continue that sort of portfolio career of freelancing for a while until I found what's now my dream job and decided to put it down and become an employee again.
What are the biggest barriers to people often doing what you're saying, which is accepting the uncertainty, not over planning it, being prepared sometimes to step out of what you thought you were going to do and try something different? What have you found have been the biggest personal challenges? Because it's not easy. Again, you know, many of us like the certainty financially, certainly many people like the certainty, and their parents may well like the certainty of certain jobs. What have you gone through when you have stepped out, and how have you managed, you know, the worries, the concerns, the good old imposter syndrome, whatever?
Oh, I absolutely resonate with the imposter syndrome. I feel like I have an emotional cycle I go through where I'm elated that I got a certain job or contract, and then I freak out that I have absolutely no idea how to do it, work really hard to figure it out, and look back and go, wow, I did that. So knowing that that's a process, knowing that that's a cycle, really helps me do it again and go, you freaked out last time, Lydia, and it turned out fine. So just doing it, having a great support system around me, friends and family, definitely helps. But I think I also, in more recent years, have really become keenly aware that the fact that I'm a white, middle-class, educated, able-bodied, heterosexual woman has meant that I haven't had certain barriers that other people who hold different identities to me do have. And so while it's been hard work and luck that has allowed me to do that, I need to acknowledge that those factors about me have meant that I've experienced certain things that other people might have had more challenges with. So it's really important to me to make sure that I'm now using my career to break down barriers for other people in their careers, to help them be able to embrace uncertainty without it being like, well, if I jump out and do this, I could be discriminated against, for example, because my name doesn't sound like an Anglo name on my CV, and so I shouldn't give this a go. I think the last thing I'd say on that is I've started to think about being paid to learn rather than being paid to do something that I already know how to do. The world is changing so much and so fast that we need people who can learn really fast. So I start pitching myself to people for new contracts of work or a new job to say, I haven't done this before, but here are the skills that I have and evidence that I can learn really fast and do new things. Would you come and pay me to do this for you? So my advice for graduates and anybody in their career really is to say, do you think you can learn how to do this? How can you convince people that you can? And that makes for a really exciting career, embracing the unknown, especially if you're aligned with the person you're working for, that that's what you're doing, and that you're going to learn and work hard and you will get results.
Kind of radical honesty in a way, isn't it? We're always, you know, tempted to finesse. Goodness, there's a long tradition of Kiwis going to London and essentially faking their CVs and still doing just fine. But what you're saying there is if you know yourself and you're honest about yourself and you pitch things as they are. Again, a lot of this is about risk based on knowing yourself and your values, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And if this year has shown us anything,
yeah,
it's that we don't know what's going to happen, even when we think we do.
Are we going to see you home sometime?
Oh, I certainly hope so. Yeah, the plan is to move back to New Zealand. I mean, it seems like paradise looking at the rest of the world right now. I'm loving what I'm doing and feel like I have some things to finish off here. But the plan is definitely to move back home and reconnect with family and friends at some point in the future.
Lydia has got